Welcome to the New York Times Podcast, your hopefully not too futile attempt at a warm embrace of music news and criticism. I'm John Caramonica. With his right hand on his rifle, he swore it on the Bible. My daddy said shoot. Oh boy, did he. That's daddy lessons. That's
Second Amendment edit.
Yes. Beyonce and the Dixie Chicks, which—
That's what it's called?
I called it that, but they add that verse in the—
would be on the vinyl. That was on the vinyl, on the B-side of the vinyl. That's how. That's what it would be called.
Yes. That's a joke.
I like that. Sorry.
So— We are playing that song because I am joined today by two of my dear friends, Joe Coscarelli, pop music reporter.
I'm here.
I'm here with Wesley Morris, New York Times critic at large.
Hey, guys.
And we are going to try to make some sense out of recent events. And by recent events, I mean attempts when different aesthetic interests have tried to reconcile and make peace with each other. Yes. That is what I mean by recent events. So, we will begin by talking about the CMA Awards. Last week was the Country Music Association's 50th annual award ceremony. It was largely a pretty tepid affair, except for the moment about two-thirds of the way into the night when Beyonce performed Daddy Lessons from Lemonade and performed it with the Dixie Chicks. Both of you engaged with this content. This was content that you guys engaged with. Let's talk a little bit about first how this came to be. Because let's talk a little bit about the backstory. Let's talk about Lemonade and when Daddy Lessons first came out.
So Daddy Lessons was sort of a left turn on the album, right? It's a country-influenced song. It's running with Texas blood. You know, it's Beyonce talking about her family situation.
Allegedly.
The lineage.
Because Daddy is dead in the song.
Right.
Right. Dead to me.
Yeah.
Dead to all of us. Yeah.
But it's about passing on wisdom, about facing down your—
Those who would hold you down.
Exactly.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And
men.
Shooting at them.
Men.
Metaphorically.
Yes. Men. Yes.
Men.
But it has a sound that we didn't really ever get from her, that we knew maybe was kicking around there, but we hadn't heard explicitly Beyonce doing a country song. And the songwriter she worked with, Winter Gordon, a similar sort of country influence vibe, and they came together and they made a song that I think surprised people. Wesley, were you surprised when you heard it?
The first time I experienced it was through the visual album,
right?
So when it shows up,
trademark.
I mean, at this point, I'm all exactly because I'll never use that term with anybody else, and I barely want to use it with her. But halfway through, I mean, this is less than halfway through. It's like a little before the halfway point. Mm-hmm. I already think I understand what's happening. And we've heard at this point, 1, 2, 3 different sounds.
By that point,
And I loved all of them. And this was another thing that I just felt like Beyonce could just do. What took her so long to try to do this? Mm-hmm. I love the twang she has. I love the register she sings that song at. You can imagine Miranda Lambert doing that song.
Yes.
But there's also something specifically Beyonce that in the arrangement, you know, the hardness of the drum programming, maybe.
The horns are great.
And the horns, I mean, there's just a lot of really nice touches that give it a musical depth that I really like.
Also, I think if, say, that same exact song had been presented to a country singer, a Miranda, a Casey, or whoever, there would have been a gratuitousness in the arrangement that I think would have softened the power of the lyric.
How do you mean that? That's really interesting.
I think that some of the choices about the density of arrangement on the original, I think in country would have been too much. I think country is about achieving a lot with a few gestures, at least contemporary country. So I think if you had given someone the same lyric and the same melodic line and told like some Nashville session guys, like go in and fill in the gaps, basically, it would have been much twangier. And I don't mean in vocals, I mean in sort of like instrument choices. The drums would have been a lot more spare. And it probably would have been, it's interesting, it would have been probably a lot like a Brothers Osborne record. Brothers Osborne, who won at the CMAs, it would have been a lot like that. And the Brothers Osborne, it was weird to see them win, because I remember even when their first songs came out and when this album came out, I remember thinking, like, I don't know who this is for. Not in this climate. Not in this climate of, like, Florida-Georgia Line into Thomas Rhett into Brett Eldredge. Like, I just don't know who this is for. But obviously there is kind of like a post-Chris Stapleton, like, authenticity wave.
We're already sort of post-Chris Stapleton authenticity waving?
I hope so.
I mean, I'm not objecting to the
Lord knows, Chris Stapleton has very sturdy shoulders, but he is carrying a lot.
I know, but it's so much.
Free Chris Stapleton.
Yes. Seriously, post.
Free Chris Stapleton from the guilt of the Nashville music industry. Just as a sidebar.
Oh, you mean it's the industry that's on his shoulders?
I think that they have basically, the industry feels that it has sinned for a decade, and then Chris Stapleton came along, and they were like, just give him all the awards, like just to make us feel better. For, like, all this other stuff that we did.
Interesting. That's a great read.
But as far as Daddy Lessons, people
Jesus, Joe.
Got into this.
Who's the host?
You know, we could do a Chris Stapleton podcast, but, you know, next time.
Totally fair.
People automatically realized that this could have some sort of crossover potential, right? And you saw that.
There was a conversation right away. Right. Like, oh, could this go to country?
And when I talked to somebody, last week about the Country Music Awards, and they said, you know, the idea for this performance on the award show hit them as soon as they heard that song. They were like, this is Beyonce's country song. We have to capitalize on that as Nashville.
The CMA said that.
Yes, the CMA said that. And the Dixie Chicks.
On the record?
On the record.
Hey.
The Dixie Chicks also automatically laid some claim to that song. And
by covering it on tour. They've been touring all summer. There are numerous videos of them performing that, and they perform it. The Dixie Chicks show is like, I would say 50% a rock, 60% sort of like a rock show in heavy quotes, and 40% like a fake in the round thing.
Yes.
Not that you can do it in a round.
They sit on the stage in front of a screen.
Yes, and they sit in a row. They don't sit in a semicircle.
Right.
But it's meant to approximate being in the round.
Like when Bieber sits on the couch and does
It's exactly like that. Yeah, when he covers Ralph Stanley. It's really
fun. Just to be clear, we're talking about like actual musicians right now and not
damn,
like,
son.
Not what Bieber's. No. What? That's not a shot at Bieber. What? It's just the guitar
Wesley,
on the couch part.
Wesley, you have to leave now.
I'm down. Okay. I just want to make clear that we're not saying the Dixie Chicks are Bieber-level musicians.
I'm not equating them. No. The way the Dixie Chicks covered Daddy Lessons reminded me of how Bieber covered Cry Me a River.
That's fair. Well, first
everybody's
of all,
getting penalty points today. Literally everyone.
That Joe, you know that wasn't about you.
I know.
I just wanted to make clear for listeners that there were no.
You probably thought that shot was about you.
Okay. Thank you, Carly.
No problem.
Moving on.
So the Dixie Chicks have been covering Daddy Lessons, and let's talk about the potency of the Dixie Chicks covering Daddy Lessons. Literally, for many years after the 2003 incident where the Dixie Chicks said, you know, at a London concert that they were ashamed that the president of the United States was from Texas, which is their home state.
Hashtag not my president.
Siri, while we're here. After that, they basically get excommunicated from country radio, from country touring, and they basically are dismantled.
Right.
They put out an album a few years later with this anthem called Not Ready to Make Nice. Makes no waves whatsoever. It's on VH1 a lot, but it makes basically no real waves
won
in the country.
Won a Grammy, but won no a Grammy. Country.
Well, yeah, won a Grammy. Yeah, because by that point, they become a sort of liberal cause celeb. But eventually, there are some solo or side projects and solo records that happen. And the Dixie Chicks are basically a memory. They're an ancient memory. That they, of any country group, would choose to embrace Beyonce's Daddy Lessons is probably not surprising. That said, I have seen Luke Bryan cover Jason Derulo, so, like, what, you know.
Sure.
This is, let's not all get up in arms about how weird this is. It's not that weird.
No, not at all to me.
But it's pointed.
I just PTSD'd with Luke Bryan covering Jason. Sorry, I just had a moment.
I was hoping one of you would.
So, yes, it's not that strange. But it is pointed. And that has been happening for 3 months now, or 4 months. And what we learned on Twitter the day after the CMAs is not that the CMAs, like, stitched that together. It's that the CMAs invited Beyonce, and Beyonce said, yes, but I need to bring the Dixie Chicks. What did Beyonce know about the power of saying that she needed to bring the Dixie Chicks? Wesley Morris.
I think it means so many things.
Yes.
I think this is a woman who understands how women get treated. I think this is a woman who sees in these other three women power and fearlessness and risk. Mm-hmm. And I think that she understands, like, these are musicians. She loves women who do their own stuff.
From Texas, no less.
And from Texas. And, I mean, I don't know what her actual thought process was, but I'm going to extrapolate from the decision that she kind of thought it was weird for them to ask her, and she didn't want to be exploited or, like, be seen as having been exploited. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, there's a kind of morality in bringing the Dixie Chicks.
Yes.
And there's also a confrontation in bringing the Dixie Chicks in this show.
And let's expand upon the kinship that they have, right? Like, Beyonce on the Formation Tour is selling T-shirts that say, boycott Beyonce.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which
yes.
allude to her own recent political gestures
yes.
and the response from fans and police
mm-hmm. yes.
groups and, you know, various
Our
internet
future
commenters.
Attorney General, Rudolph Giuliani. Yes.
People yes. who say, you're a pop star, shut your mouth about politics.
Yes.
And so in her
own experiences, you're a black woman, keep your mouth shut about politics.
Right. Obviously, yeah. she feels some sort of solidarity with what the Dixie Chicks have gone through.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Look at who was on that stage throughout mm-hmm. the course of those mm-hmm. 3 hours. Mm-hmm. If you take away, say, the first 10 minutes, which were the sort of like tribute to country music, like the last 50 years, and sort of like your Merle Haggard tribute and your Randy Travis moment, you take that away. And you say, well, in those remaining 2 hours and 45 minutes, who's the most important person on the stage of the CMAs? It's definitely Beyonce.
Oh, I was going to say Taylor Swift. besides Beyonce. Sorry.
It's definitely Beyonce. And Beyonce, I think, is very aware of the amount of leverage that she had in that mm-hmm. position. And she mm-hmm. knows perfectly well mm-hmm. that if the CMAs are coming to her, I don't want to say hat in hand, but basically with this gesture of like,
let's be honest.
Okay, hat in hand.
I don't think the show needed her at all, but still.
But they knew that getting her was
a big deal. Yes, yes.
They come to her, hat in pocket or hand, somewhere hat. There's a hat. And she says, okay, I don't want to be taken advantage of, like you say, but I also don't want I don't want it to go for naught that mm-hmm. I've come. Because mm-hmm. obviously there's root level confrontation
yes.
that's involved in
yes.
bringing her.
Yes.
Beyonce is not unaware of what that is. So I think part of it is I'm going to partially deflect some of that confrontation and make it a bigger conversation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And part of it is like I'm going to have this act of solidarity by saying, mm-hmm. oh, you want me? Oh, you got to let them. You got to.
I think there's,
you
a
gotta
price, there's a price you're going to have
cousin
to pay.
Cousin Natalie yep. and cousin Mark, like, and cousin, they all got to, you got, they got to be at the dinner
Although,
table.
let me put
You
one,
haven't invited them in 10 years.
Let me put one point there, which is for this 50th anniversary celebration.
You made this point to me the other day, Joe.
The CMAs also decided that they would invite every past winner of Entertainer of the Year, mm-hmm. you know, the sort of big award.
Dixie mm-hmm. Chicks have 10 of these, by the way.
That includes the Dixie Chicks.
And they were formally invited independent of that?
So they were, because everyone who had won this award was to be invited, mm-hmm. the Dixie Chicks were going to get an invite as well. Now, by pairing them with Beyonce,
let's get forensic with this.
By having Beyonce bring them, that sort of clears the CMAs of having to put them up in some other way.
But do you think that the CMAs would formally have actually invited the Dixie Chicks?
I think they would.
Did they go on the record saying that?
Yes, they told me that they invited the Dixie Chicks were always invited because every past winner.
Were they going to Skype them in? Like, how are they going to?
That's what I'm saying. They had to figure
Come
out
to
what
to
do with them.
From Marty's living room in Los Angeles.
They had to figure out what something to do with them. So letting Beyonce bring them along as her cause is easier for them than having to shoehorn them elsewhere.
They were like, we got a WhatsApp message from Emily. She said, sorry. She sends her best.
It's easy to just let them be Beyonce's issue as opposed to
their own thing.
Right.
But again, I'm just getting chills thinking about just how amazing, like, that this actually happened then under those circumstances.
Yes. It's a point of tension for every single participant.
It is a completely loaded situation.
Mm-hmm.
All four of those women know it. They, I think the Dixie Chicks in the moment, in the event, were very nervous.
Mm-hmm.
They seemed nervous to me,
mm-hmm.
especially at first. I think, you know, everybody did their Texas, mm-hmm. and I think it was Emily who went last, and she was like...
Yeah, no, I thought... I couldn't tell if that was rehearsed or if they were like, Emily, you got to say Texas.
Right.
Like, I couldn't tell if she forgot or...
No, she seemed like she was off mic or whatever, but yeah. It was a little bit like... And Penny.
But also think about the dynamic within the Dixie Chicks. Because mm-hmm, yeah. there was this long period of time when, I don't want to say that Marty and Emily were carrying Natalie's political water, but...
They were.
When they all spoke forcefully. When they did that Entertainment Weekly cover, it wasn't just Natalie right. who showed up. They all spoke out. But this is Natalie's group. No if shots
it, yes.
on Marty and Emily, but this
she
is Natalie's group.
She was made into Bono in, yes. in a way that was and sort they, of beyond. Their control.
And they had to carry it. I'm sure they all agreed to do this performance, but I also think that if Emily seemed a little bit more sort of like reticent coming to the mic, it's probably because she's trying to stay out of the way of like
so
the...
Nerves aside Fair. At the beginning yes. of the performance, one thing that struck me about it, given how loaded it was, this is a powder keg, it went off so smoothly.
Yeah.
It was
Although
beautiful.
A little it's, too smooth.
All right. It sounded good. Like, you know what I mean? If you didn't know the context, you could have watched that award show and barely blinked when it came and went.
That yes. I agree.
Yes.
I agree with
and
that.
And then came the fallout.
Yes. Although, can we just like hover on the performance for yeah, like 30 sure, more yeah, seconds?
Sure, sure.
I know that it was deliberate and it was deliberately done so as not to kind of like raise an eyebrow in the larger picture. It was done not at the show opener. It was not the show closer. It was like two-thirds of the way in. If you could have just been going to the bathroom and come back yeah. and be like, oh, this is on. And I understand that designing a disruption to be minimally disruptive, I understand there is power in that, but it is also a little bit of a cop-out. And I know
on
that-
On the show's part.
On maybe their part.
And the performance. We had this conversation as well, Wesley, off mic, which is that there are a lot of politics in the subtext of this.
Yes.
I could have done
yes.
with
you
a
wanted
little
more
yep. overt disruption.
I also think like they are, as musicians and as singers, both parties are capable of much more rousing
yes.
approaches.
I agree, yes.
And at the end of those 5 or 6 minutes, I was left feeling a little bit empty. As much as I enjoyed it, I felt like it was a little bit of a blown opportunity. You can contend that them doing that thing on the CMA stage at the 50th anniversary show for that audience is inherently the resistance.
That's how I feel.
Yes, but like, why was the Justin Timberlake, Chris Stapleton thing last year way more rousing than the Beyonce Dixie Chicks thing when Beyonce and the Dixie Chicks are far more rousing performers than Justin Timberlake and Chris Stapleton?
I think there are two answers to that question. One is the song choice. I mean, you could take the song apart and rearrange it to make it more than what the song actually is
on
its
face,
right?
Let's do it.
I think that actually might have been a time issue. I don't want to speculate about why they didn't do it. But I also think that they understood or they were gambling on people, on me having my response to it as opposed to trying to figure out how it could have been more confrontational. Let's talk about some ways in which it could have been
yeah.
more aggressive.
And also, like, confrontational is maybe not the exact word, but I mean, and I guess it's confrontational to who?
It could have been a more fun performance.
It could have been it could have been more of a moment
yes.
apart. Like when that thing was over, I was like, that was a moment because I know the political and social
yes.
import of it, but I wasn't like, wow, that was an insane musical.
But
moment.
It doesn't at all. I mean, I feel like one of the things that made it extra powerful is everybody in the room knows what's going on.
Yes.
Everybody. Mm-hmm. And it happened the week before this election.
Totally.
What you really have, and 2 days before Beyonce went and performed an endorsement of Hillary Clinton mm-hmm. for president, there you have the politics of the country
yes.
facing each other for these 6 minutes. And the people in the audience, they know exactly what this is. There were very few reaction shots of people in the crowd. Mm-hmm. There were maybe two.
They didn't mm-hmm. want to sell anyone out.
Right.
Except Kenny Chesney.
Who
had to apologize. Right.
For not looking happy
right.
enough.
Right. I feel like...
He was just thinking about climate change, guys.
So...
Like, he's concerned about the Caribbean. You know,
right.
he's got places to go. Like, he's just worried.
I also think that you want to be... And if you're Beyonce, you're a lady. you want to be a little bit respectful of
somebody else's
host.
Right.
The hosts.
Like if they, right. So,
yeah, but at the
I
same time, it's like, is this the time to totally be respectful of the host?
Well, I don't know.
I
think so, yes, because it wasn't like it was on its face. The CMAs are not a political award show. You know, the CMAs haven't done anything bad, unquote.
And the politics of the show up to that point, obviously, this was days before the election. Mm-hmm. It was very even-handed.
And it almost always is.
Yes.
Like Brad,
yes.
Brad Paisley and Carrie Underwood, who are the hosts of the show and have been the hosts for 8 or 9 years, every year they open up with a sort of like hee-haw-ish comic music routine.
Red stay, blue stay.
Yeah. And it always. And also, I mean, I'm pretty sure Brad is like a Democratic. He's spoken out or registered Democrat. There's something with Brad and being a Democrat. Carrie, TBD. But I do think that they like to play with the idea of country as redneck space and as, as sort of conservative space.
A lot of
and
artists
poking
do.
Fun, yeah. And poking fun at in both directions.
Yes.
So especially in this particularly contentious political season, I was very curious actually to see how they would handle that. I think they're funny. Let's just say it. I think they're funny.
Yeah. I think so too.
Yeah, I think they're fine. I think they're my favorite award show hosts, apart from Tina and Amy.
No shots. I totally agree.
Yeah.
I just feel like the material is getting thin.
You wanted a little more from them.
Yes.
Yeah, but I feel like in aggregate over many years
versus Billy Crystal.
Yes.
I mean,
I'll take them any day.
Well,
they're not confrontational. It's the same thing. To your point,
but they're neutral and they set the tone for a show.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, this woman comes in from, like, some other music town, blows everything up and takes her rebel country stars with her. I'd feel weird about that as a viewer in a weird way.
Okay, well then, can we talk about the racial anxiety of country music?
Well,
Let's talk about the racial anxiety of country music in the last 5 years.
Yes.
Which has both, I feel... It's heightened and it's lessened. It's lessened in terms of aggregate parts. You think of the intrusion of hip hop and R&B gestures into country music and dance music gestures into country music. This is probably the most polyglot moment in Nashville since country disco.
Right.
You know? So this is actually a legitimate thing that's been happening.
Yes.
But at the same time, they're still like conservative political anxieties in the music.
Musical pushback against those inroads that hip hop has made.
Yes. Again, Chris Stapleton.
Right. Well, for starters, right.
I mean, and shouts Chris Stapleton, who I'm sure like probably listens to, I don't know, maybe an NWA record every now and again.
But I'm thinking even more explicitly than Chris Stapleton. I don't know. It's just good manners. Like, you're going to perform this song anyway. Like
with these people,
and in the middle, you're going to put "Long Time Gone,"
and let us be
which is a song about the passage of all of the stuff, the belief in the passage of all this stuff that led to the result of this election in the first place.
Mm-hmm. And also, let us be clear that for all of the griping that we are doing about maybe the performance not being as arousing or confrontational as we would have liked, it was received as such.
Let's talk about the reception. Joe Coscarelli on the reception. Let me set the stage a little bit, which is to say this happened and there were two... I want to say they were simultaneous reactions. I don't think one was a reaction to the other. I think they were both reactions to the sort of core text.
Yes.
One was this pseudo-fascistic backlash against how the CMAs had like violated the purity of country music by having Beyonce.
And not by anything that she had done, but
just by her sheer presence. And this was happening on Twitter even before the
performance. You don't think that also had something to do with the baggage she brought as Beyonce? Or do you think it was just the mere Beyonce?
Which baggage are you referring to?
The belief that Black Lives Matter is a terrorist organization.
Of course.
All
of
okay.
yes. all,
this all is
of
what you're talking
not,
about. When you,
it wasn't based on what she did on the stage.
Right, okay,
it was based on her
being on the misconstrual and everything
that she represents.
And that was clear because the backlash began before she ever stepped on stage.
Yes.
That's number one. And then the parallel backlash, which is the Beehive.
And the Beehive, in my view, were upset that Beyonce's performance with the Dixie Chicks wasn't getting the same promotional attention from the show on their various social media channels and websites.
As other performances did.
Now, there are logistical reasons for this, and there are cultural political reasons.
Give us
for this.
The give us yes. the 15 second breakdown of why they did not. Just the facts.
According to the CMAs, the reason they hadn't that Beyonce's performance with the Dixie Chicks was not spread widely on their social media channels was that they didn't have the rights to the video or the images. That's what they said. That, you know, when an artist agrees to be on these award shows, certain agreements are made about who takes the photos. Mm-hmm. Beyonce brought her own photographer. If you look on Beyonce.com, there are a lot of beautiful photos of this performance. Those photos were nowhere to be seen elsewhere because
on CMA channels.
Because Beyonce retained the rights to them.
Mm-hmm.
Same goes with the video. It's complicated. At the same time, what the CMAs avoided by not having a lot of Beyonce posts
was not having to deal with that.
Was not having to deal with a waterfall of racist mm-hmm. and angry comments from white country fans who believed that this was
sullying
the name of the culture and the genre.
And to be fair, they didn't get to avoid it altogether right. because if you went on the Facebook page with the CMA, it was on every other post.
So even posts that had nothing to do with Beyonce right. on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram were filled with comments.
Yeah, you just want to say a nice thing about Kelsey Ballerini and you got to navigate all this.
All you see
all this
is
terrible,
how
racist.
Dare you have Beyonce. Yeah. She doesn't support the police, just mm-hmm. like the Dixie Chicks didn't support our president and our military, and you have this backlash popping up in every corner of the internet, and then it's a whack-a-mole game, right? It's like, even if you don't have Beyonce's photo there, mm-hmm. people are still going to find a mm-hmm. way to say that mm-hmm. they feel like you as an award show mm-hmm. wronged them by showing Jesus this black Christ. Woman yeah. for 6 minutes.
It was kind of, mm-hmm. like early voting. That's how it felt.
And then the Beehive, obviously.
That is funny.
The Beehive comes back, and then you see CMA Instagrams filled with bee emojis
yes.
and lemons, and then it becomes an internet war that uncomfortably mirrors what we
events
see
of,
in real yeah. life.
There's a really interesting corollary between, and this is going to sound crazy, but between the Beehive and Trump supporters.
Speak it.
They're obviously coming from totally different places.
Sure, yes.
But their mobilization capabilities,
mm-hmm.
their ability to get from like one end of the country to the other in 10 seconds.
Online radicalization.
I mean, the energies are similar. And they're obviously put
to different
ends. I
would say one comes out of, I would say,
one is a reaction to the other.
One comes out of perceived oppression, one comes out of actual oppression.
Right.
Like, that's, you know, like, if we're just going to be.
I mean, but like with that understood,
sure.
right? I mean, of course, yes. But, and all I'm saying is that there is a degree to which their ability to sort of police for injustice is just as strong as the opposite end to manufacture it.
And also, it's interesting you use the term policing. I'm reminded of, in September, Beyonce was like maybe going to perform at the Emmys or maybe not going to perform at the Emmys or whatever. And there was something that one of the Beehive stan accounts posted, which was a DM message with the producers of the Emmys. Mm. I mean, these are people that, like, even the god Joe Coscarelli is not getting on the phone, but they are in the DMs of, like, the Beehive stan accounts, and they were upset because they felt like they had been used. And so they were basically trying to police Emmy producers and saying, don't you dare use us. Mm. Don't, like, tell us. Don't tease us. Don't say Beyonce's coming, and then we go to work, and we put the machine in motion, and then you sell us out. Mm. Like, never again.
What'd the producers say? I'm just curious.
I think it was kind of like, I'm so sorry. It was sort of like that. It's like kind of in that
Please
ballpark.
Stop commenting B emojis on all of our accounts. Don't at me.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah, never at me.
I will say, Grease was really something. I mean, as a production, I love me some lemonade,
Wesley,
but listen, it was on the spot.
Wesley.
Like,
oh,
the
man.
Cameras were dancing.
Yo,
that
Wesley,
was really
yo,
amazing.
Your takes are so hot.
By the way, I think the album is so good. Like, listening to it now, I listened to it last
lemonade?
Week.
Which of?
Taking the Long Way.
Yeah.
Really, really good.
Because
it's divorced now from the moment, right?
Yeah.
In the moment, everybody thought they were going to come out and like be like, fuck your country music. Fuck y'all.
It's really good.
It is a fucking really good album.
In a weird way, it anticipated the moves of, I think, probably 5 to 10 years later,
yep.
which is like the pop smoothing out, mm-hmm. the VH1-ness of country.
Yep. Yep.
It just sort of went there because there was nowhere else for them to go.
Yep.
That was a moment where, you know, country was, I think, a much narrower moment. Also, King of 2003, I mean, this is the era of Toby Keith. This is the era of Alan Jackson's Remember When. I wrote an article the same year the Dixie Chicks thing happened. I think it was the same year. about this recurring motif in country music videos of this weeping soldier, even in songs that were not about the military at all, but they would just be like random soldiers crying and like hugging their children. So this is a very, very narrow political and aesthetic moment in country music. And the Dixie Chicks, they said, "We are not ready to make nice."
They only said it once, though.
That's true.
And the rest of the album was fantastic in this totally other way.
So, in order to soothe the room a little bit, that was a little bit of Dev Hynes. That's Hands Up from the most recent record. And on this week's podcast, I wanted to do a couple different things. I feel like, given that we are in a moment that is saddled with division, I wanted to talk about these moments in culture that have also sort of brought to the fore some of the struggles that we have on our side of the world. I play the Dev song because a thing that happened last weekend was an event. It was called the Boiler Room Weekender. And this took place in Pennsylvania in the Poconos. And it ended in arrests and police presence and Discord, people trying to film people getting arrested and having their phones taken and smashed.
The event was canceled.
It was canceled. Last few hours of the event were canceled. So Boiler Room, for those of you that don't know, is basically a series of dance music and dance music adjacent parties that take place in generally non-traditional spaces, and they are closed events, and they are broadcast over the internet. So theoretically, you can be anywhere in the world, and you can have access to all this culture.
And increasingly, the events themselves travel.
It's been in different cities, but the ambitions are getting bigger. And this is basically was a virtual festival, and it was a virtual festival this past weekend, with, I thought, a really ambitious and smart lineup. The Ghetto Gothic crew was there. Dev was there. Kamasi Washington. If you look at videos from
Jamila
the first.
Woods. No, so, yes. Yeah, yeah. Some great artists.
Very, very ambitious. Like the No Vacancy Inn guys. And if you look at videos from the first day of the thing, or first night and into the day, it was at one of those kind of like adult camp, water parky type things.
Yeah, it was a resort in the Poconos for people to pretend that they're at summer camp.
Kind of, yeah. And, you know, it was beautiful. It was a beautiful crowd, great hair colors, great outfits. It's the type of party that you would be at in New York and still be like, wow, this is cool even for New York.
It's colorful in every way.
Very, very beautiful. What happens when you lift that up and take it out of the presumed safe space of New York City and dump it into a county, a town, a state that doesn't have a long history of dealing with stuff like that? What happens is maybe something like what happened. Obviously, we don't know all the details, but certainly the discourse surrounding what happened kind of is about the culture clash of the world.
And attendees felt that security was overbearing. Mm-hmm. There were invasive searches.
Especially in the Ghetto Gothic room.
Right. And all sorts of, you know, what I think attendees have said were oppressive tactics to in the name of safety and security.
Yeah, and I read one person say that, like, you know, when white kids were caught with drugs, the security told them to throw them away. But when black kids were caught with drugs, then they were harassed much more significantly, right. And at least one person was arrested.
Right. So this resulted in local police then clashing with concert goers to the point where there was an arrest that was being filmed, and at some point the camera phone gets knocked away, and then the event is a wrap.
Yeah, and in watching the sort of fallout from that, I felt very similarly to watching the fallout from the CMAs, which was this real deep level of frustration about people's abilities to allow each other to be heard and not shout down the others. Also, you know, Boiler Room is something that largely is operated, I won't say totally independently, but seems to be primarily independently. But this event was thrown with Ray-Ban, and they were given a tremendous amount of money to kind of build something from scratch. There were bigger things that were happening that no amount of corporate money was going to fix.
And you want to think that an event like this is about harmony and about, you know, bringing a group of people who care about a similar aesthetic realm to to the wilderness, to play that out with some senses of freedom and openness. And instead what we get is an ugly collision of worlds.
Yeah, and I don't want to be too kind of too hippie-ish about it, but the potential for cultural exchange is really high. You sort of exporting this rather high-level culture into a part of the country that doesn't ordinarily have it. I'm not sure if there was any setup. I mean, this is maybe something we'll find out in the next week. Was there any setup to sort of like interface with the community, the local community, and say, hey, we're welcoming you into this?
Odd sound low to me.
I would venture to say that is correct.
Knowing how people who do these things tend to think about the places they
do. Blame can go around for something like that, about not making the proper cross.
But what a great opportunity it would have been. I'm sure there are hella local teenagers super excited to have access to something like that.
Sure.
And probably would have helped local understanding as well.
Well, who lives in that area of the Poconos, though, is my question. I mean, is it in the resort realm of the Poconos? Like, what part of... Was it at one of the resorts?
It was at one of the resorts.
So, really, there's no community. I mean, I'm from Philadelphia, very familiar with not going to
But there are no town. There are no towns near there, like, where the local
there
people
are,
who
but
work
it's
at the
not,
resorts.
It's not like that up there. It's not like a place where, like, you'd be leaving your house to go hang out at this thing. You'd be a resorter who kind of was maybe hip to it already, or you got a place just to go to this event.
You don't think there's, like, wild, bored
it's
local
not like,
teenagers?
It's not like having it in Hartford.
Sure.
Or
no,
it's
of
not
course.
Like, it's not like of having course. It in, like, Ferguson.
So you think it's more of an issue of communication between security, police, and concert goers?
Absolutely,
and organizers.
Yes. And I also think that the idealistic relationship that John rightly thinks it should have with a place that it has traveled to, I mean, I think part of the reason they picked that location was that it was kind of contained
and
it
it's
did
off
come
the
with
grid,
security,
isolated.
Right? And
although apparently one of the issues was that the resort insisted on using their security instead of allowing a Boiler Room to bring security, presumably more familiar with the crowd,
right,
more familiar with how to manage an event like that. Apparently there was some tension around that.
Sure.
Well.
And these are issues obviously that come into play in Manhattan and Brooklyn as well. Mm-hmm. Something we've talked about this year.
The
policing of rap shows and in the
Free
wake
Bobby
of,
Shmurda.
In the wake of the shooting in the spring at Irving Plaza. So we're not immune to these confrontations.
Yes. It was just a particularly poignant weekend for something like that to happen, I thought.
I always wonder when these things happen not infrequently. Not the kerfuffles, but the sort of traveling road showishness of certain party situations.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I never understand why security doesn't understand like what young people do around music. You know, what young people do outside of tents, what young people do like in the fields.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That always sort of bewilders me. And then you add the natural biases and predispositions of certain law enforcement people, whatever went down seemed kind of inevitable, right?
But wasn't that a sad feeling? That was a sad feeling that I had because I had considered going to this event. I thought the lineup was great. And definitely in looking at the email or the flyer or whatever it was and seeing where it was, my first instinct even before the thing was like, something's going to go wrong here. Like, it just doesn't, like, just my... And that's a terrible thing for me to feel, but you could have called it. In the same way you could have called what happened with Beyonce and the CMAs. Like, you could have called that before that.
Oh, yeah, you knew instantly.
Right.
I mean, that's just how the world works now.
Yes.
Like,
or does it?
Can we talk about something going right?
Or does it, Wesley? I'm so glad you said that because maybe I have the solution to these problems. Okay, could we talk about solution? I feel like we're sitting here and we're bound by
these
problems.
People need solutions.
I need a balm.
Let's do it.
Let's balm. Let's talk about Martha and Snoop's potluck dinner.
By all means.
On VH1, which had its premiere the night before the election.
Yikes.
And turned out to be, I thought, just the tonic the country needs.
Welcome. I'm going to be making a three cheese pizza with spinach and mint and a topping of delectable black truffles. It sounds delightful. So delicious.
Just to clarify, I'm not high right now, but whoever gave us this show, they must have been.
Martha, who is Martha Stewart, and Snoop, who is Snoop Dogg, have a show in which they both cook versions of the same dish. In the opening episode, it was fried chicken.
Yeah. She claims her recipe is better than his.
Right. Hers is brine and buttermilk for 2 days in the fridge. His is made with potato chips and cooked in like 6 minutes. Now, this is sort of the premise of the show, is that it's like a cook-off between their two teams.
But also a dinner party.
That's where it gets fun. So it's a dinner party, and Martha, on Martha's side, and helping her with the cooking, was Wiz Khalifa. Just let that
go over your tongue. He brought his own herb.
Yes, true. KK. Special ingredient. On Snoop's team, his sous chef was Seth Rogen. And then the final dinner guest, who comes in about halfway through the show, is Ice Cube. Now, just for a moment.
Wah!
Yes.
Wah!
Exactly.
Wah! Wah!
Now,
okay, done. Just want a little reenactment.
I just want to bask in the moment, because when I was watching the five of them on stage, I thought to myself, like, yes, like, this is the America I've been fighting for.
And I think Seth Rogen says something like, this is the craziest group of people
ever to be on one stage.
But also, I was like, this is exactly right. And this is also the logical end product of, like, years of hip-hop's incorporation in the popular culture, years of Martha Stewart becoming cool, like, years of VH, like, years of the popular, all the years of everything.
Ice Cube starring in family films.
Yeah, right. It's all converging on this one moment. And I felt really happy.
This is the weirdest group of people ever on a stage together.
I make fried chicken a wee bit better than Snoop.
Oh, Snoop, look at this.
Oh, wow, look at this.
It's a piece of weave in there.
Martha, let me try that again.
I want to add the truffle topping.
It's like a mushroom.
It's like a mushroom. Do it do what mushrooms do? Because if it is, I'm a fan of truffles now.
You can grate the nutmeg.
You want me to break these nuts?
No, I want you to grate them.
Grate these nuts?
Great.
Oh, grate these nuts?
The way that the show is structured was very much to kind of play up the wackiness of it. And it felt almost like a 1950s take on a 2010s
this
phenomenon.
This is one of my, like, it's a problem I have with the show, really. Yeah. But it's not a large problem. It's just a production problem.
But I think it's by design.
Right.
And I think it's
winking.
It's winking.
Yes.
Tell me about your take on it, Wes.
I love it. It's great. I will check in with this.
Yes.
I'll probably just skip right to the dinner party part, because I find all the scripted patter to be, like, neither one of them is comfortable reading it.
No.
And some of it is bad.
Yes, it's unnecessary.
And even the good things they can't quite sell. I don't think somebody in this situation does not like rehearsal. And
I wonder who.
I don't. Wow,
Mom.
I love the idea of this. I love what it represents, both big and small. I love food shows. I love watching people cook on TV. I don't really know why. It's a strange thing to want to, like, enjoy watching that genre of television.
My bomb has been Chef's Table in the last few weeks. It's very calming.
Yeah.
Very calming.
MasterChef Junior. What is the thing that sort of, like, set you off a little bit about the 1950s-ness of it?
I think it's so self-consciously the thing that you like about it.
Yeah.
I think that it knows that it can push that button without doing a lot of work to push it. And I wish they would zig a little bit more.
It's only been one episode.
So we don't know what else the show has up its sleeve. What I should say then is I hope
that it zigs
that they try to get them a little more comfortable improvising. Because you don't need that scripted patter, right? It reminded me actually of a game show.
Yes.
It reminded
me.
Right.
It was like a 1950s. It was like brought to you by Edsel.
I was thinking about like the 60s, like late 60s Laugh-In era, like where, like, you know, you had people doing that show who could actually read a script and who could memorize lines. But if there's just a way to get them off book, I think the show in the early segment can be great.
So besides the fact that this aired on Monday night and I haven't seen the ratings, caveat there.
But have you read the comments?
Besides the fact.
Oh, no.
But that's what I'm going to ask you. Besides the fact that, you know, maybe not that many people have seen this yet. It just started. It started at an inopportune time, mm-hmm. maybe as far as attention spans go.
Mm-hmm.
Why isn't the Martha Hive going ham in the comments about their discomfort with this combination of people? Why doesn't this stir
I don't
people
think those
in
women,
any way?
I'm not blaming Martha Vance.
Right, right. That's a joke. But why doesn't it unsettle people?
We don't really know that it doesn't, though, right?
But Martha's brand is also more complicated. It's not as straightforward a value proposition as being like sort of like a country music conservative.
Yes, yes.
You know, Martha's had a complicated 10 years.
Yes.
She has been to jail. She has had her company decline and grow again. There are rough edges to the Martha brand that I think if you signed on for it, you understand that it has like weird.
Right. And it's airing on VH1. It has burst. So it's in a little bit of a.
Or they might just not know it's on.
It's in a cool space. I also think that Martha is in enough people's lives and in enough non-chic ways that the people who are with her, I think her coalition is broad.
Yeah.
I think it's a range of people, and it's not people who look like Martha Stewart.
I also think we're in an interesting moment with characters like that, because if you think about cooking shows on television, like you saw the thing recently where Action Bronson was on the Rachel Ray Show, and I'm like, this makes such a weird amount of sense.
Yeah, that's kind of... feels obvious.
Right.
In a way that this does not.
No, but I think we're at the point where if you pay attention to shows of that nature,
mm-hmm.
you're used to seeing rappers as guests. You're used to seeing weird actors as guests. You're used to seeing YouTube stars as guests. I think those shows demand so much in terms of the churn that you can't only have, like, who's the person who's dating Prince Harry from Suits?
I don't know her name.
You know, whoever that be the
who?
Beast. Yes, the who's dating Prince Harry. Like, it can't just be a steady stream of folks like that. I think it's just changed.
Minor people in cable TV shows.
Yes. I think the umbrella is much wider now. And also Martha and Snoop have like an established public friendship prior to this, which is actually sort of why I find it weirdly charming that I know you're right that they could be going off book and improvised, but I find the weird structure of the show strangely reassuring, especially in this tumultuous time.
Well, let me ask you guys this. Are you bothered at all by the easiness of the jokes that boil down to you're white and I'm black?
The implicit ones I think are interesting, right? Like, this is how this stuff happens so that it seems less loaded. There's a trailer that they play where Rick Ross is going to show up at some point.
Yes.
And he backs up on her and she's like, "I like your van," or something like that. Like, or what's this? Like, she makes some large penis joke.
Right.
You know.
It's actually funny. And like, he gets to own the joke. It's not her presuming anything.
Mm-hmm.
It clearly was fed to her probably by Snoop or Rick Ross. Mm-hmm.
Or by
she's so embarrassed to have to. She's so embarrassed by having said it. She covers her mouth immediately, and it's like there's a version of Martha Stewart that I think Conan O'Brien actually got to first. Right, Conan O'Brien I think is the person who most successfully recast her as somebody with a personality or somebody who. And I mean, in a weird way, she really was like, she and Hillary Clinton have so much in common.
Interesting.
And
Martha for president.
And well, the racial things on this show, I mean, I don't know about you, John, but they actually so far don't mind them. It's more like the I'm stoned all the time and from Snoop and like her like, oh my God, what is weed?
Yeah, I think
from her, that's a little.
And I think the racial things on the show don't appear to be premised upon Martha's discomfort with race. If anything, they're premised on her comfort,
which
is an entirely different category.
Like, he's breaking rules about how she proceeds in the kitchen that drive her crazy.
Yes, and her thing is like, I'm happy to try this weird potato chip, weed-infused chicken, and also I'm happy to have Rick Ross
and
flirt
I think
with me.
That is the show's power. Is dismantling the presumptions around comfort, right?
Right. But again, that is why I like the framework so much, because it is a framework that is explicitly designed to communicate comfort. Right. It's not something that relies upon that kind of improvisational flair.
And I think
it's literally like a Leave It to Beaver level of comfort.
Yes, yes.
And that is something that I think, I mean, this is why Duck Dynasty works. This is why Keeping Up with the Kardashians works. I mean, these are 1950s era structurally shows.
Yes.
And that is the weird left field appeal of this. It's not the culture clash. It's that they get along in this very kind of like friendly way.
And the point that Matthew Schneier, a reporter here, made in his style story about this show is that, you know, Snoop and Martha have a lot more in common than not, which is they've both been very wealthy celebrities for a very long time with very diverse brands who can sort of move in circles
various
with
spaces.
Ease.
And I think people like that about them. The other thing I would just say, there's a scenario in which this is, I think, what everybody, I don't know, 14, 15, 16 months ago, thought Donald Trump would be doing.
You mean this, like for his...
This is the show that Donald Trump would have been doing had this not worked out for him, I think. And
would Rick Ross appear?
18 months ago?
Yes.
Like, yes. Absolutely yes.
Maybe 28 months ago.
Okay.
Long
that's
election cycle.
I don't know.
I feel like, let's just set aside the politics. I mean, forget who Trump actually is, and let me take a like a time window off it. I just think generally, irrespective of his running for president, I think one of the things that kept people from taking him seriously was obviously his TV pass.
Yes.
And this idea that, like, he was a kitsch artist who would wind up taking the thing that made him him and doing something like this show. It's, and you totally can imagine him doing it.
And this is where, you talk about the Martha Stewart brand. Like, Martha Stewart is almost tofu-like in this way, where she's just as effective on a 9 a.m. cooking show or a 9 a.m. morning show as she is on this weird structured thing with Snoop Dogg.
Right. Or like after-hours show for stoners.
Yeah, like she can take on, like she can retain some essential Martha-ness, but bring that in a molded way to all these different contexts. And I think that's probably what you're talking about with Trump, that there was some essential Trump-ness, but it wasn't a structural essential. Like, there's nothing structural. It could have been inserted into almost any setup.
It can mean
it could
anything.
Have been a game show. It could have been a game show.
Yep. Like, he could have been a Richard Dawson. He could be he could be taking Steve Harvey's job right now. Right. You know what I mean?
Yes. Well, no one takes Steve Harvey's work.
That's what you think.
Hey. Let's go out with What's My Name by Snoop Doggy Dogg.
From the depths of the sea, back to the block, Snoop Doggy Dogg, funky at the dot. Went solo on that ass, but it's still the same. Long Beach is the spot where I serve my cane. Follow me, but don't lose your grip. Nine tris, eight, the years.
Thanks for listening to the New York Times podcast. Thank you to my guests, Wesley Morris and Joe Coscarelli. You can read all of us who wrote about the Dixie Chicks and Beyonce on nytimes.com/music. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, and wherever else you get your audio. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez. We will be back next week. Be safe, though.